welcome to you all, and a very warm welcome to Lady Hale, our very special guest for this evening. When I've done these in the past, I've normally done a short introduction to our guest, but I'm going to eschew that tonight because I think everyone on the event tonight will know exactly who Lady Hale is. But what I hope to do this evening is perhaps just to dig a little deeper and go behind the title and behind some of the achievements and find out who Lady Hale is and where she has come from. And that's really where I want to start, Lady Hale, if I may. I think that's fair to say that you grew up in a world of education. Your father was a headmaster, your mother was a teacher. Was there an expectation that you too would go into teaching?
No, I don't think there was an expectation that either I or my two sisters would necessarily go into teaching. But there was an expectation that we would go to university and so be educated as much as we could be. What we then did with it, I think, was very much a matter for us.
What was your best subject at school?
The one I liked the best was history. I'm afraid I was pretty good at all of them.
Yes.
When my headmistress and I were discussing what I might do for A-level, I said, well, why don't we wait and see which subjects I do best in at O-level? And she said, no point. You're going to get good results in all of them. So, sorry about that.
No, not at all. The reason I ask, I suppose, is what sort of careers advice would you have received at a school in the 1950s? I mean, was there careers advice as such? Because you had to choose your A-levels, you had to decide what you wanted to do. And today, of course, we're very focused on employability, and if you choose this, you need to choose that, and you're going, you know, and so on. How did you make those decisions?
That's a very interesting question. There was a careers advisor from the local authority who came and saw all of us, I think, when we were in the fifth form, that's the O-level year. And I said to him, well, I'm going to go to university. And he said, well, you shouldn't be so sure about that, you know, quite difficult to go to university and so on and so forth. So I gave him up as a bad job. I mean, the school had various expectations. You know, people, a few girls would go to university, a few girls would go to teacher training colleges, a few girls would go into nursing, and others would go into banks, insurance companies, secretarial work of one sort or another. So there was a limited range of occupations that we were expected to pursue. But that doesn't mean to say that they stopped us doing anything. It's just that they didn't have very expansive ideas about the possibilities.
So no one said to you, oh, you could be a barrister, or you could be a doctor, or you could be, you know, an accountant? Or
We certainly had some students who went to become doctors. It wasn't unknown for girls from the school to become doctors. Going back to what you were saying, my best friend at school wanted to do some rather weird things. She first wanted to be an occupational therapist, and the school didn't think much of that as an idea. And she went off to be a social worker, which again was pretty unheard of for anybody in the school. So, yes, we had to display a certain amount of enterprise to go and do something unusual.
So you'd chosen your A-levels. Obviously, during your final A-level year, you had to apply to university. How did you choose law? I mean, even then, it wasn't a very usual choice, even for people who wanted to go into the law, because people often go and read history or classics, and then they would read for the bar or, you know, read the Law Society finals. So who suggested law to you?
Or did you I suggested law to me. And it probably was in my final year, although in those days, if you were going to apply to Oxford and Cambridge, which I was, it was customary to stay on for a third year in the sixth in order to take their entrance exams. And so the choice really had to be made when I was filling in my application forms for Oxford and Cambridge, which would have been at the beginning of my third year. Yeah. My headmistress was a historian, and so we had thought that I would go and read history, but she said to me, I don't think you're a natural historian, Brenda, i.e. I don't think you're clever enough to read history. What else might we put you in for? Because you're obviously clever enough to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And she suggested economics, which I didn't fancy one little bit, because it was all too theoretical for me. And I suggested law. And that, I am convinced, is because I had become fascinated with the constitutional history of the 17th century and the battles which led to setting up the modern constitution, then for England and Wales, now for the whole UK. And I thought that was a very dramatic story and a very interesting story, and one I wanted to know more about.
So up at Cambridge, I think it's interesting to put some context around that, because, you know, in 1963, women would almost have been invisible in the law. Very few women practitioners, either as barristers or solicitors, and almost no women lawyers or judges. I mean, almost no women judges. I mean, almost none. I think that the first one was 1945. You know, there were a few, but it was really unusual. So did you think when you were studying law, I'm going to do something completely different with it, I've enjoyed it? Or did you think, I want to go into practice?
I thought, let's dip my toe in the water. I was attracted by the idea of going to the bar, as so many young people are. And of course, I was surrounded by law students who were taking it for granted that they would go to the bar, because there were that sort of well-connected, entitled young men were around. They weren't everywhere, they weren't everyone, but there were plenty of them around. So I applied for a scholarship to join an inn of court in my first year, because everybody who was going to the bar tended to want to join in their first year, because then you could get all your 36 dinners, your 3 years worth of dinners eaten before you did the exams, and then you go straight to the bar. Strange world it was in those days.
Well, they're qualifying sessions now. Yeah.
But they didn't give me a scholarship, and I don't blame them. You know, I had no connections. I knew nothing very much about anything, and I wasn't yet, of course, getting very good exam results. So, but I was rather put off by the fact that somebody who did get a scholarship was not getting very good exam results and was the son of a High Court judge. Which to my mind was so unbelievably unneedy that I thought, no, this is obviously not for me. But I spent my long vacations working in solicitors' firms, one of them up at home in Yorkshire, a small firm, and the other one of the Magic Circle firms in London. So I got a taste of both ends of the solicitors' profession. And I was actually going off to do articles with the Magic Circle firm of solicitors when I think I chickened out of doing yet more exams, because you went off and you did 6 months as a course and did your exams, and I was working so hard at exams, I thought. And my director of study said, well, you could go and teach in a university, you know, that there are several jobs being advertised now. So I went off and looked for the jobs that were being advertised, and there was Manchester and there was Bristol, and so I applied and I got them. And the great thing about Manchester was that they wanted me to qualify as a barrister and practice as well as teach. So that seemed to me I was getting the best of both worlds.
And it's right, cute now to speculate what would happen if you'd chosen Bristol. So.
Oh, I think, you know, I became Chancellor of Bristol University many years later. Spent 13 happy years dressing up in a fabulous robe and giving degrees and prizes and this, that, and the other. And one of the things I had to do was to give medals to people who had been working for the university for 40 years. And they ranged from gardeners to Nobel Prize winners. So I reckon that if I'd gone to Bristol, somebody else would have given me a 40-year medal, because I'd have found it so agreeable that I would have stayed in Bristol all my working life. Which would not have been as exciting as the working life I have had.
Indeed not. Just again, to give this a bit of context, my former chancellor at my previous university, Janet Cohen, Banners Cohen, when she applied for certain training contracts, one firm that she doesn't name replied saying that they didn't take female article clerks because they didn't have any ladies lose. So,
yes, I think I would have been the first woman at the firm that I was offered articles by, but I had spent a month there working in a long vacation. So obviously I haven't frightened them too much. And no doubt they had ladies' loos for the visitors so they could. And for the staff, of course, they always have plenty of women staff. It's rubbish.
Yes. I mean, there's that famous photograph, even from the 1980s, of Herbert Smith Partners. And there's one woman standing in the middle and it's all a sea of men. And that's 1980.
Yeah. You're right.
So a law lecturer in Manchester, you did pupillage in Manchester. And famously, you're quoted as saying is that your pupil master somehow had revealed that he didn't approve of women at the bar. I mean, it seems utterly bizarre today. But I mean, how could he justify that?
Oh, well, no, it was good fun. He'd been persuaded to take me on by a Manchester graduate who was doing very well at the bar. And that said Manchester graduate had told me that my pupil master didn't really approve of women at the bar. So halfway through my pupillage, I plucked up courage to say, rumour has it that you don't approve of women at the bar. Is this true? But we were getting on like a house on fire. He was a lovely man. And he said, yes, it's quite true. I don't approve of women at the bar. Why on earth, said I, your wife's a doctor and she practices as a doctor, despite having 5 children as well. And he said to me, well, that is fine. Medicine is a caring profession and women should care and can care. But the bar is a fighting profession and women shouldn't fight and can't fight. They're either too stubborn or too yielding. So he didn't think that fighting was something that women could do. Well, he was right about the bar, but he was, of course, completely wrong about women, as he was later to discover.
At some point, you had to make a choice, didn't you, between your teaching role and bar. Was that a difficult one to make?
It was quite difficult, yes, because I enjoyed doing both. I mean, I love teaching students, and I loved the bar work that I was doing. But obviously, you couldn't go on doing both for very long because each got in the way of making a successful career. Now, you couldn't do the research and writing that academics have to do. You couldn't take the long cases, which, of course, are the way to make progress in a bar career. So I did have to choose. And my husband then was also starting out at the Manchester Bar. So one reason for my choosing the university was that university teachers get paid. They don't get paid a great deal, but they do get a regular salary and sick leave and holidays and pensions and the like. Whereas barristers starting out at the common law bar, very difficult. You wouldn't know where the next brief was coming from and you wouldn't know how long it was going to take you to get paid, if at all, for that brief when you did it. So it seemed a good idea if one of us had a stable income and the other didn't. Another reason was that we wanted a family, and it did seem rather more sensible to be in university, combining that with having a family, rather than being at the common law bar way. You know, you have to drop everything and shoot off to Carlisle the next morning with a brief you haven't had time to read, so you're going to have to read it on the train, etc., etc. It's not very family friendly. You need very good childcare arrangements. But I think that one reason was that although I enjoyed being a barrister, it was good fun arguing with people, always has been, I wasn't in love with it, whereas my husband was in love with it. The moment he had started, he couldn't imagine doing anything else. And that, of course, is a very necessary qualification for being a successful barrister. You have to fall in love with that crazy profession to really make a success of it. And I wasn't in love with it in quite the same way that John was. And so I think those are the main reasons.
So a very successful
good reason.
A very successful career as an academic, researching, publishing, teaching. If I had to put you on the spot saying teaching versus research and you could only do one, which would you choose?
That would be really difficult because I think, I mean, I agree with the idea of a university, which is that people who are at the top of their game academically and who are thinking new thoughts, writing new thoughts, making discoveries in various in other areas, etc., sharing those with their students and also learning from their students because of what their students do for them. That's the idea of a university that I subscribe to. So one or the other doesn't seem to me to be true university teaching, although I do understand that there are people who are better at teaching and there are people who are better at research. I think we nevertheless need to do both. So I enjoyed doing both. The one thing, of course, I didn't like about being a university teacher, and I'm sure everybody feels the same, I didn't like examining.
Yes, marking. Yeah.
Marking. It is very hard work. And if you've got a course which deals in end of year exams, you have to mark a great many papers very quickly. So you have to be very decisive. You have to be very quick, very decisive, very fair. It's good training for being a judge, but it's, it wasn't something I enjoyed.
Well, I always used to mark to Mozart, Lady Hale, because I think there's something that, you know, it speeds up the brain.
Oh, right, I agree. Doing it to music is a good idea. Mm.
So 18 years as a very successful academic, and then the first woman to be appointed to the Law Commission, I think the youngest person to be appointed to the Law Commission. Did you apply, or how did this come about?
Well, it's quite a long story. There were two vacancies in the beginning of 1984. And for the very first time, the Lord Chancellor's Department decided to advertise. So they were advertised. And I was planning to apply. But that was because it was a full-time job in London, living in Manchester, but my husband was planning to apply for Silk, which he hoped would mean that he would also be able to join London Chambers as well as Manchester Chambers. And then at the very last moment, he decided it would be premature to apply for Silk. So I thought, well, I won't apply for the Law Commission. So, and then I got a phone call from one of the Law Commissioners who said, it has been noticed that your name is not amongst the applicants for this. And they were advertising for a family law commissioner. Was that because you have definitely decided against it, or could you be persuaded? So I said I could be persuaded. So I went down to London and was interviewed along with the other applicants. I mean, there were plenty of other applicants. I wasn't the only one. And after the interview, I wrote and said, please treat me as an applicant. So I did apply and I didn't apply, if you see what I mean.
I think I know the answer to the next question, but your most important achievement as a commissioner?
It's got to be the part I played in the Children Act 1989. I mean, that was very much a collaborative effort with the Department of Health and Social Security, as it then was, and the Law Commission. And also, of course, there were teams working on it in both institutions. So lots of people were working on it. But I was leading the Law Commission team and playing a very large part in the Department of Health and Social Security effort as well. So, yes, I think that probably is the proudest one. But I'm not unhappy about the Mental Capacity Act either, which was also very much the product of the work of the team I led when I was at the Law Commission.
And I think it was while you were at the Law Commission that you had your first judicial appointment as a recorder. Did you have nerves the first time you sat?
Oh, of course, yes. In fact, I had been approached, tap on shoulder stuff, you know, in those days. I'd been approached in 1982, before I went to the Law Commission, by the Lord Chancellor's official who was in charge of judicial appointments, saying, we'd like to diversify the recorder branch, not in terms of gender or ethnicity or anything like that, but in terms of having some academics with professional experience sitting as well. So I committed myself to doing that before I went to the Law Commission, and I started sitting as an assistant recorder in 1984. I was promoted to a recorder in 1989. And yes, it was the most nerve-wracking thing that I have ever done, no doubt about that. Especially sitting in jury trials. I think the county court judging, the family judging and the civil judging, no, that's fine. It's down to you. And if you mess it up, well, okay, somebody will put you right. But the formalities of a criminal trial are in many ways, and were then particularly, quite counterintuitive. And so one was always worrying that a perfectly good trial would be set at naught because of something egregious that the judge had done. So it was nerve-wracking. Yeah. But you get used to it. You learn.
It certainly didn't put you off, did it? Because 1994, the High Court beckoned.
Yeah. No, it didn't. Yeah.
When you went to the High Court, did you feel at a disadvantage in any way? I mean, what I suppose I'm really bluntly asking is, did you feel welcomed? I'm sure everybody was charming and polite, but charm and politeness can hide other things.
Well, they can, of course, but I don't know. I just sail on, you know. Mm. I wasn't aware of any mutterings, really, at all. And in any event, I just carried on regardless. And I enjoyed, I mean, the work in the family division is extremely challenging, the most challenging of my judicial career, in fact, because it's all down to you. You know? You're finding the facts, you're exercising the discretion, you're interfering in people's lives in very drastic ways. You're also taking risks. If you're doing your job properly, you know, taking a certain number of risks. And if you don't do that, well, what's the point of having a judge there? So it is quite nerve-wracking.
And again, to give that some context, I mean, of course, the first High Court woman judge was Elizabeth Carr. And then the second one, that was 62, and then 74, Rose...
Elizabeth Lane.
Yeah, Elizabeth Lane. And then Rose Heilbronn in 74. So actually quite a huge gap between that. And then the first, and I think historically, they seem to be appointed to deal with family matters, regardless, I think, of their background or experience.
Well, both Elizabeth Lane and Rose Heilbronn had Queen's Bench practices, very successful Queen's Bench practices in crime and personal injury, which was mostly what Queen's Bench practice was in those days. But of course, they were put in the family division.
Patronising.
I'm sure they did a perfectly good job there, but who can say? But one assumes that they were not trusted to be somewhere else. The next two appointments were Margaret Booth, who was a family specialist, and Elizabeth Butler Sloss, who had been a family judge in the district registry, in the principal registry of the family division. So those two were family specialists. But it was a bit of a feature in the early days.
Before your appointment in 1994, I think 2 years before, we'd had the first woman to the Queen's Bench Division, and then the year after, the first woman to the Chancery Division. So things were starting.
Absolutely.
But how slow? Incredibly slow. And I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of very young people on the call today, but 1992 to me seems like yesterday. So from the High Court to the Court of Appeal, following in Lady Butler Sloss's footsteps. Again, I know she's on record as saying that things were perhaps challenging for her initially, as the first, you know, Lady Justice of Appeal. When you arrived, things had improved, things had changed?
Oh, yes. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, after all, and there was another long gap. I was 10 years after her. But the personnel had changed. The master of the rolls, who was basically head of the civil justice system and presided over the civil division of the Court of Appeal, was not, I think, very welcoming. In fact, quite the reverse to Dame Elizabeth. Whereas by the time I was appointed to the Court of Appeal, the master of the rolls was the great Lord Wolfe. And he was extremely welcoming, very friendly. I mean, he looked after all his judges brilliantly. So the atmosphere was completely different.
From the Court of Appeal to the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords. 2004. I remember as a pupil barrister going with my pupil master, who was a junior on a case, and we went to the House of Lords. And it was the most extraordinary old-fashioned experience. I was sort of mesmerised by the whole experience, because, of course, we're all outside in the corridor. Mm-hmm. The law lords go in, convened as a committee, and they're all in civvies. We're all dressed up to the nines. Very bizarre. Presumably you welcome the creation of the Supreme Court, but do you think it's made any difference in the end, other than, you know, regularising things like that?
Well, let's not minimise the importance of regularising things like that. I mean, it was entirely bizarre. You will recall that the barristers and parties and everybody sort of massed in the corridor outside. And then suddenly the law lords popped up through a door opposite onto the corridor and filed in one by one in single file and bowed to the bar. Of course, the bar bowed back. And they were preceded by a doorkeeper in an amazing outfit who called out their lordships so that you all knew that we were coming. But I persuaded them to call out their lordships and her ladyship when we processed onto the corridor, which was a great triumph. But no, things like that were a pain. We managed eventually, after a few months in the Supreme Court, to persuade the barristers that they didn't need to wear robes and wigs. As long as they all did the same thing, they could dispense with wigs and gowns and bands as they did. So that now everybody's in civvies, which makes for a much more civilised atmosphere. We are televised, of course, which bizarrely we weren't in the House of Lords. The one bit of House of Lords business that was not broadcast was judicial business, which seems extraordinary. Whereas we had cameras, our own cameras, right from the word go in the Supreme Court, very unobtrusive, pretty unnoticeable. And we are in charge of what is broadcast and how it is broadcast. So it's not like letting the television cameras on, very obtrusive, and they're deciding what is broadcast. All sorts of things like that. We could start giving judgment in our own way rather than having these bizarre debates on the motion that the report of the appellate committee be agreed to, which is what we did in the House of Commons chamber when we gave judgment. Nobody knew what on earth was going on. But now everybody does know what's going on. All sorts of things like that. Much more opportunity for outreach, for school programmes, you know, a lot of school visits, a lot of student visits. Students always enjoy coming and mooting in front of justices or having debates in the courtrooms and sitting in our chairs, which they all enjoy. So, yes, it's a very different place.
And I suppose a practical basis, it's great to have somewhere where your clerk can sit properly, where you've got access to a proper library rather than sort of books down corridors and things. So I'm sure, and of course it's physically such a beautiful space as well. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it's also a symbol, isn't it? Because it's actually saying this is really important. It's not just a committee room off a corridor. This is actually where it happens.
Yes, that's right. As you say, it's not just a rather obscure, quite elegant room, wasn't it? The committee room in the House of Lords was quite elegant. But what it had above their lordships was the most appalling painting of the death of Harold. I don't know if you remember that. Okay. A really dreadful, gory picture. We couldn't see it because it was behind us, but it was in front of the barristers. I think it must have been a bizarre joke that somebody decided to play on the barristers just to put them off. Make the experience of appearing in front of us even worse than it already was.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my pupil master was terrified. So.
Well, I think it is. It is quite nerve-wracking appearing in front of the top court in the country, and we are very engaged. You know, we ask a lot of questions, so a lot is expected of the barristers who appear in the Supreme Court or the advocates, and so it must be pretty terrifying, even so. But we try not to be bullies. We try not to be rude. We try not to be nasty. We try to do things, I think, with a smile on our face rather than in the way that it sometimes was done in the past.
So 2017, President of the Supreme Court. I think I'll be remiss if I didn't mention perhaps your most high-profile case, which was all over the press, obviously, for some time, the proroguing of Parliament, which is a decision that you described, a ruling you described, as a source not of pride, but of satisfaction. Could you just say a little bit more what you meant by that when you said that?
Well, it was difficult to find the right word, the right phrase, because we take no pride in telling the government or a public authority that what they have done is unlawful. You know, we'd rather that they weren't doing unlawful things. So it's not a source of pride or indeed satisfaction to have to do that. But what we could, I think, be very pleased about was the way in which the court had responded to the challenge. Because there we had something that had blown up over the long vacation, basically in August. We'd got cases in England and in Scotland, and those cases had reached different conclusions. They couldn't both be right, because England had said, nothing to do with us. Scotland had said, oh, yes, it is something to do with us. And by the way, it was unlawful and it is void. Parliament has not been prorogued. So they couldn't both be right because there's only one UK Parliament. So we obviously had to take the case and we had to decide it, and we had to decide it as quickly as we possibly could. And we had to convene the largest panel of serving judges that we could convene. That's 11. We have to sit an uneven number, so we couldn't all 12 sit. But we convened 11 judges for the previous case brought by Mrs. Miller, so it would have looked bad if we hadn't brought 11 in. So we managed to rejig everybody's plans for what they were going to be doing in the third week in September and get everybody there. We managed to get the parties to get the papers in order. The Scots were particularly good at that. And then we had to hear it in 3 days. And obviously we had to agree a judgment within a very short time, because otherwise there would have been no point in the case. And we managed to do all of that. So I think that is a source of some satisfaction.
I'm very conscious that I've been very selfish and monopolised the conversations that were in asking my questions. So I thought I'd move on to some of our alumni questions which were sent in advance. And I've taken the liberty of grouping them into themes. And the first one is around judging. And the first question is, what's the best part of being a judge? What's the buzz?
Oh, it's listening to a case, and most cases turn out to be interesting because there is a debate to be had. I mean, obviously there are some cases that decide themselves, but in the High Court, Court of Appeal, and above all in the Supreme Court, they don't decide themselves, because by definition in the Supreme Court, it's an arguable point of law of general public importance. So there are at least two sides, and there may be many more. So listening to both sides, obviously doing some work on it oneself, reading up and so on, and then trying to work out what the right answer is in a methodical way that's consistent with principle, but maybe also a bit practical. It's a wonderful job. It's absolutely lovely. And then trying to explain it in as clear and simple a way as you possibly can. Obviously, these are complex issues, and often you have to go into them, and the underlying law may be complicated, and so you do have to go into that. But just to try and explain it in a way that law students could enjoy to read, then that's another of the challenges which I thoroughly enjoyed doing my best at.
The second question on judging is, do you think women bring something different to the art of judging?
Well, I suspect that some women do, because we are all different. I mean, women are very different from one another, just as men are very different from one another. We're not all the same. But as Beverly McLachlan, who was the Chief Justice of Canada, a very successful Chief Justice for many years, put it, actually when she was speaking in a committee room in the House of Lords, she said, "We lead women's lives. We have no choice." So our experience of life is inevitably different from men's experience of life. And we bring that experience to our judging. And sometimes I think it helps us to understand things that it may be more difficult for others to understand. I was particularly struck by the former Chief Justice of New Zealand, Dame Sian Elias, who said, if you've had the experience of humiliation, you can understand others' experience of humiliation much better than if it's never happened to you. And of course, as a woman starting out at the bar in New Zealand, she had had the experience of humiliation, and that enabled her to empathise deeply with the Maori population, which is, I think, one of the attributes that she could bring to her role as Chief Justice.
And the last question on judging is, have you ever doubted a decision that you've made after a case is over and think, did I really get that right?
Yes, I think so, but it doesn't do to dwell on it. I think this was particularly so in the family division, when you were making the first decision and you were deciding to take children away from their families or deciding not to take them away from their families, when you knew you were taking a risk, because the simplest thing was always to take them away. But you knew that this was not a panacea that was going to cure all evils. And so, yes, you would worry sometimes about it, but it's not a good idea to worry about it. You could easily distress yourself far too much if you worried too much about it. You need to worry enough to try and get it right. But once it's done and dusted, it's probably better to try and stop worrying.
We've had a number of questions about access to justice, with somebody quoting the old adage, you know, the law courts, like the Ritz Hotel, are open to everyone. And as you know, Lady Hale, I'm chair of Support for Court, a legal charity that supports litigants in person. And when I explain why we're needed, I basically point to April 2013, when LASPO came into force, and legal aid not disappeared, but virtually. Do you think we can have justice without proper access to it?
Well, I think, forgive me, I think what you're asking is, can we have justice without access to lawyers?
Yes.
And I think the answer to that is, yes, you can have justice without access to lawyers, because there are numerous, hundreds, thousands of tribunal cases which are now decided without access to lawyers. And they can't always be getting the wrong result. I'm sure they're getting the right result. And so justice is being done in a great many of those cases. There are now more and more cases in the ordinary courts which have to be decided without access to lawyers. And I hope that the courts judiciary are equally learning from the tribunal's judiciary how to deliver justice in a lawyer-free world. It's really difficult, of course, if one party is represented and the other one isn't, because you want to try and level the playing field as much as you can, but you have to try and do that without appearing to be favouring the side that you are trying to level up. So it's a very challenging thing for a judge. It's much easier, so much easier for the judge if they've both got good lawyers. I mean, that really does make life as a judge so much easier. So yes, you can have access to judges, to justice without access to lawyers, but it is much harder and much riskier. And also, the thing that bothers me even more is that LASPO took away not only access to lawyers for litigation appearing in court, but for everything that goes on before that. And most legal problems that people have can be solved with a bit of legal advice as to what the position is and what your options are, and a bit of legal help. You know, writing the odd letter to the other side or lifting the phone, negotiating with the other side a sensible solution to the problem that's arisen. That solves most legal problems. It certainly does in the family's world. There is no need for people in private family law most of the time to go to court to battle out what the solution for their children should be or for their money should be, because it's usually all sorted out between the lawyers. And now that legal aid has been removed from all of that, Well, then many more cases are coming to court, but it's so much more difficult for husband and wife, mother and father, to negotiate between themselves when at that point they're not the best of friends in any event, and they don't know what the law is, they don't know what the court's going to be interested in, they've got nobody to tell them, well, look, you know, you may think this is right and this is wrong, but actually the court's going to want to know this, this, this and this. So what do you say about that? And then negotiate an answer to it. So on all sorts of levels, what has happened since LASPO is, well, I was going to say unfortunate, but that's too weak of a word. But I don't want to, I don't want to use too strong a word either. So, but not a good thing for the justice system.
I'll say it's regrettable.
Yeah. I think it's more than regrettable.
Some questions about your personal success. You've achieved so many firsts as a woman. Has this, in your very high profile, you know, legal career, has this put extra pressure on you, or you've only ever felt it as an achievement?
Oh, I think both. I mean, obviously, it's very satisfying to be the first woman doing a particular job. But in my generation, it wasn't too difficult to be the first woman, you know, because as you pointed out, you know, when I qualified as a lawyer, there were very few women about, and there were very few women in senior legal profession positions. So there were plenty of opportunities to be the first woman. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to big it up too much. It wasn't that difficult. We were a rarity. I've also been the second woman, I think, rather more frequently than I've been the first. And I think being the second woman is a great compliment to the first women who didn't frighten the horses or pull up the drawbridge after them. And so I'm eternally grateful to those first women to whom I came second in my career. And one of the things that really, really worried me in the House of Lords stroke Supreme Court was that I was on my own as a woman for so very long, 13 years before they appointed a second woman. And I did begin to wonder what I was doing wrong.
Another question is, there will be many young women attending this event for whom you have been a beacon of inspiration. What words do you offer to women setting out on their journey in law and those, for example, who aspire to be barristers?
Ah, well, it might be a little bit different between the two. What I always say is you must try to be the best you can at what you are doing now. And you will only be the best you can at what you're doing now if you enjoy it. So number one advice is enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, then you'll work hard or effectively, efficiently. Just putting in the hours, isn't it? It's effective use of those hours. And if you work effectively at something you enjoy, well, then you will be good at it. You'll be the best you can be. And if you do all of those things, well, then you will have set yourself up for the world ahead of you. But of course, the world ahead of you is a very different place from the world that I went into. There are many, many more lawyers, many, many more law graduates. And we've just been talking about the reduction of public funding for legal services. So that does reduce some of the opportunities available. But at the same time, there are also a lot of law jobs around. So once you've qualified as a lawyer, there's a whole range of things that you can do with that. That weren't as apparent when I was starting off. So on top of being the best you can, seize the opportunities that come your way, even if they weren't quite what you were expecting. Just as I wasn't expecting to become an assistant recorder, but I seized the opportunity because it seemed like an interesting challenge. So do that, and then you'll find yourself having a great career. And actually, I would say the same to all intending barristers as well. But I'd say a lot more to intending barristers, because I would also say you need to be reasonably crazy to go to the bar. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you, Peter? You do need to be reasonably crazy. Especially if you plan to go in self-employed chambers practice as a sole practitioner. because that is so different from going into a firm where eventually you can make a profit out of other people's labour, you could share the risks, you can share the benefits. It's, of course, completely different from becoming in-house counsel somewhere. So you're taking a much riskier path, and it doesn't suit everybody. And you're also taking a path into a career where you've got to spend your time standing up to judges. Now, in all careers, you have to stand up to people. Standing up to judges is a very special skill. Not everybody's got it, and not everybody's got the courage to do it. And so you do need to think very carefully about whether you really, really, really want to do it. But of course, if you really, really, really want to do it, then you've got to try and do it. Because you'll always kick yourself if you didn't at least give it a try.
The next question was actually asked by a number of alumni, which I think reveals the ambitious nature of our alumni. What advice would you give to aspiring judges?
That's very difficult, isn't it? Because in our system, you don't get to be a judge until you have made a name in some other part of the legal forest. So, of course, the first bit of advice is be a success at what you're doing in whatever part of the legal forest you're in. Because that is going to be actually a necessary qualification for becoming any sort of judge. If you get the opportunity to do, I mean, you don't become any sort of judge without having first done it on a fee-paid part-time basis. So you need to think about which fee-paid part-time opportunities you would like to go for. Obviously, studying the Judicial Appointments Commission's website and what there is, and what you think would suit your particular skill set and expertise set, and look at those and then work out how best to try and apply when you get to a stage when it's a realistic thing to try and do. Because it isn't realistic to do it too soon or to apply for the wrong job. So a certain amount of mentoring, and there are now mentoring schemes available, it is a very good thing, because that'll help you to decide how to get your foot on the first judging ladder. But a lot of us did start out in tribunals. My very first judging job was as a legal chair of mental health review tribunals, which is quite like family judging. It's a rather similar sort of managing the future, predicting risk, understanding people sort of job. And it was a very good preparation for the judging work I did later on.
You appeared on the Radio 4 show, Desert Island Discs, so we know something about your hinterland, as it were. And obviously, as I'm sure people know, you're allowed to choose 8 records to take to the Desert Island on the show. But if I were to change the word records or discs to judgments, I haven't got time for 8, we've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left, but what's your top 2 or 3 judgments that you feel, I'm so proud of those 3?
Yes. I mean, no, I undoubtedly ought to have some Desert Island judgments. There's no doubt about that. And people have asked me that before, but I've never settled down to do a list of 8, because it would be quite tricky. I think that I would have to put the prorogation judgment first. I have some satisfaction in a case called Yemshaw and the London Borough of Hounslow, which was all about the definition of violence, expanding it into what we now call coercive control. And I would like to say a case called ZH Tanzania, which was about putting the interests of children closer to the forefront of immigration decisions which vitally affect their futures. Those are the top 3, I think I would say. But of course, I'm also quite proud of some of my dissenting judgments.
In the chat, people are saying Cheshire West. They've had 3 or 4 people mention Cheshire West. So.
Yes, now that's really interesting. I tend not to mention Cheshire West, and yet it's a very, very important judgment. I quite agree. And a good collaborative effort on the part of the judges involved as well.
In the final few minutes, I think that's one thing we do need to mention, and that's that you have your memoirs, which are published officially tomorrow. The final thing I did before logging onto the Zoom was check my WhatsApp, and my partner had just sent me an image, and it was one image, and it was a spider. Mm-hmm. I think we may reminisce, if I didn't ask about Spider Woman. I think the title could just have easily been Dragonfly Woman, I think.
I am wearing a dragonfly at the moment. Yes. So, well, of course, I happened to be wearing a spider, didn't I, when I delivered the summary of the prorogation judgment. And so a lot of people did refer to me as Spider Woman, and so it was inevitable that the book would have to be called Spider Woman. And it's got a very fine picture of me wearing a spider brooch, but not the spider brooch, a different spider brooch, on the front of the book. Yeah.
It was just happenstance. You happened to select that item of jewellery to wear with the black dress that you decided to wear that day, that people then spun into a whole web of nonsense.
Yeah, it definitely was happenstance. I chose most of my brooches. I've got an awful lot of brooches, but they do tend to migrate to a particular garment where they sit comfortably and stay. And the dress that I chose to wear happened to have a spider on it. So it was the dress I chose, not the spider.
Well, Lady Hale, what a fascinating evening. We are so hugely grateful for your time this evening. Inspiration. I mean, I don't know if you've seen, but the living legend, Lady Hale, has just popped up. I'm a very great honour to hear you this evening. So endless, wonderful comments from the chat. I can see you blushing, but it has been a great...
Yes, I am blushing. Yes, yes.
Has been a great
I can tell you, I certainly didn't set out to become a living legend at all those years ago.
But thank you for your time and for sharing with us. It means so candid as well. Lady Hale, can we have a virtual round of applause for Lady Hale?